All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? Mark Maron here. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. I hope everything's okay. I don't know, man. What do you think? What do you think happened this last week? If you've been keeping up, if you've been listening, and you knew where I was at, because I pre-recorded last week, and what I had presented was that I would, you know, if everything went as planned and I was ready to sort of move through it, that I would get off the nicotine lozenges. And I'm here to report that I have. I am now 8 days off today, which will be Monday. I'm recording this 7 days off, and I'm a little less out of my mind. Some of you have been through this with me maybe once or twice before, but wow, pretty exciting. Pretty fucking exciting just to throw yourself into some sort of craving-induced mania that disables your ability to filter your emotions properly and just makes you fucking nuts in a very exciting way. It's been very exciting in the sense that if I'm going to stay like this, we're all up for quite a ride if I'm going to stay like this. I don't know if that's going to be what's going to happen. Okay, so let's do some business. I'll be at the Vogue Theater in Vancouver this Friday. I believe it's sold out. You can try. That's September 6th. I will be at the Moore Theater in Seattle, September 7th. I don't think that's sold out. I think there's still a few tickets to that. So come to that one, okay? Yeah, come down from Vancouver. You heard me right. Come from Vancouver. And coming up, these are important. They're as important as it would be if you want to see me perform. I'm at JFL 42 in Toronto on September 19th, the Vic Theater in Chicago on September 20th. That's sold out, actually. Why did I say that? The Toronto one needs support, as they say in the business. The Masonic Temple in Detroit needs a little help on September 21st, and the Pantages Theater in Minneapolis on September 22nd, my old alma mater. In a way, I've taped a special there. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for ticket info and all my tour dates for the rest of the year. All right? So here's what goes on. So I get off. I decide to get off the nicotine. I told you I was going to, which I did. But man, my brain just spread wide open, buddy. Who's the buddy, pal? Spread wide open. I'd forgotten what it was like because I was eating a lot of them. I don't know if you guys knew how many I was eating, but I was eating a lot of them, man. My tolerance was way up. It was taking a lot to fix. And, you know, it wasn't getting any easier. All day long, sometimes I go, I'd nicotine myself into nauseousness sometimes, sweaty, eye-crossing queasiness. And then sometimes I'd go to bed with them in my mouth. And when I woke up and realized they were in my bed, I'd stick them under the pillow next to me. Yeah, so they get all stuck under the pillow like a sad tooth from when you were a kid. I was strung out on the shit is what I'm saying. But when I pulled the plug on it, I just didn't realize how, like, my brain's just scrambling for dopamine. The receptors are going nuts. They're starving. My metabolism slowed down. So I, like, put on, like, 8 pounds overnight. And I've just been crazy. You know, I'm afraid to talk to people. I've done a lot of watching of television and cooking during this time and just getting through it, exercising, hiking, sweating it out. Like yesterday, I went and ran 4 miles and then went and sweated out. But it's hard with people on stage. Did 2 comedy sets, loopy as fuck, full-on improv, nicotine withdrawal improvisation, spectacular. So satisfying and weird. I don't know. How do I make my life this mode? I'd like to stay in this mode a bit without the craving, like I'm amped a little bit. It's probably annoying for you. I apologize. It'll pass. But I did a couple sets. That was good. I was also in that ongoing this weird battle on Twitter where all the Marvel Comics Universe people were mad at me, which is fine. Oh, and then they released a trailer for The Joker, and I made it in, man. I'm at the very end, me and De Niro in the doorway looking at Joaquin. Very exciting. It's going to be a dark, cool movie. Very happy to be part of it. Does not change my feeling. Anyways, got a great show today. Speaking of I think I can say nerd culture without people getting upset. I know some people think I'm a nerd. They call me a nerd because of my record thing or whatever, but I usually tap out, man. You know, I'm only as nerdy as the amount of shit will fit in my house or where I get tired of looking at it. I get past a certain point, and it's sort of like reality breaks in and says, what do you need all this shit for? Is this really your life? And I pull back. So you know what that makes me? Not a nerd, because they go all in. Not judging, just is what it is. But maybe judging a little bit, depends on what the nerd obsession is. But this guy that I talked to today, Dale Baran, he wrote that book, man. He wrote that book that blew my fucking mind. There's been a couple of books that have blown my mind. It's called It Came From Something Awful. And it really is, the reason it coincides with this sort of weird pile on by the MCU guys and women and men and whoever is involved with that. They're just their knee-jerk reaction to any sort of name-calling or criticism about their weird corporate addiction to fantasy. It was very educational, and I dug the interaction, because after I read this book, It Came From Something Awful, it taught me about the whole world of 2chan, 4chan, Reddit, subreddit, Tumblr. It taught me about the sort of all that's been going out there in those platforms, in those chat rooms, you know, in that world of disconnected, disassociated, you know, primarily men on the chans, and how that, you know, evolved out of a kind of a, you know, nihilistic disposition into meme culture, into insult culture online, and then how it ultimately manifested into mainstream culture through conspiracy theories and through propaganda stuff, because some of them were turned out by the alt-right and by old school Nazis, but a lot of them were just out there to fuck shit up. It also talks about how it kind of sprouted off into the two versions of Anonymous, the politically active Anonymous and then the hacking Anonymous, and how, you know, Tumblr was sort of an antithesis to what was going on in these kind of more toxic look, if you're my age, maybe you're proficient, maybe you know what's going on, but you know, I just used a computer. I don't live in it. And I don't know how to live in it. And I don't know about all this stuff, but it all fucking adds up. You know, it's a major piece in the puzzle of what happened in 2016 and also what happened to youth culture. And it all started with fantasy. It all started with anime on one side. The whole thing was an education to me, and it really sort of shows where and who was driving culture. Not unlike the pushback I'm getting from the collective, the MCU collective, which is, you know, I get it that, you know, that they're now empowered, but they're certainly not the underdog in terms of, you know, the effect on culture and whether or not monoculture, really, Disney-run monoculture when it comes to films. The idea is like, yeah, okay, great, they're well-made something. But, and it's like, you can tout this kind of like, well, that director is a genius or this actor is great or whatever, and they're doing these movies. The payday is one thing, but you've got to figure out how to bend your talent into this very limited world, you know, that appeals to this fan base. And they're virulent, and there's no question about that. And if they don't believe they are, they can just look at their reaction to any sort of criticism, or it wasn't even, I guess, it was name calling, but it wasn't off. But anyway, you know, to each their own. I think that was the primary theme. It's like, well, you got to make fun of things that people like, that people love. And I'm like, well, when that thing is a sort of monoculture sort of, you know, juggernaut of a very select context of entertainment that just plows through everything else and is oddly relatively limited, even if it is a universe, it's worthy of criticism, even if people love it so much that they're willing to do Disney's bidding because they're so grateful that never again will they ever have to be ashamed of liking their comic books. So Dale Baran, the guy who wrote this, It Came From Something Awful, it's one of the most, look, I've done a few interviews like this in my career here on this show. Okay, I interviewed Sam Quiñones for his book called Dreamland about the opium epidemic, which was fucking mind-blowing. because it was so engaging to me and revealed so much about the toxicity and the culture that created the epidemic and the drug companies and the American Medical Association. It was one of those books that explained so much and gave me a context. Fantasyland recently with Kurt Anderson. That was another one. That was really about the history of magical thinking in America that gave what we're going through a context. And this is the same type of book. It came from something awful. It gave me a context to understand those worlds of online worlds that created toxic trolling and then, you know, later influenced culture and also, you know, generated the army of unfuckable hate nerds, which is, you know, what I call them. And there's a little pushback on that too, but I don't know. The army of unfuckable hate nerds have done a lot of damage and they continue to. Some of them are Russian. But it just gave me context to understanding it because there was no way I could have understood it. There was no way. And now I do. And that was because of Dale's book. How about an email? No subject. Dear Mark, despite your many warnings that Steely Dan would eat my brain, I gave Can't Buy Me a Thrill a listen on Spotify and let the album play through in its entirety while I did housework. How bad could it be? Fast forward to my Monday morning Los Angeles commute where suddenly my Spotify is recommending Alan Parsons Project, Doobie Brothers. Suffice to say that Dan ate my algorithm. Keep up the good work. I love your podcast with all my heart. That Dan ate her algorithm. I'm sorry. I am so sorry, Julie. I didn't mean for that to happen. But, you know, it is kind of deep, right? Jesus. No subject again. Dear Mark Maron, thank you for helping me fall asleep when I have felt the burden of anxiety, sadness, loneliness, and resentment. Your words, filled with anger and cynicism, have made me feel a little more lighthearted at night. I wish you the best, Mark. I like when people use me to go to sleep too. Isn't that crazy? It's like a Ritalin effect. I love you people. So Dale Baran fucking schooled me, educated me, wrote this great book about the shift from fantasy into toxic mainstream culture that helped crumble our political system and, you know, make everybody feel like garbage. He got to the source. And it all started in fantasy. It all started in fantasy. It all started in fantasy. They just like anime. They just like Marvel. They just like making stuff up that hurts people. They just like doing it to each other. And now it's leaked. It's leaked. The lizard portal is open. This is me talking to Dale Baran about his book, It Came From Something Awful, which I think is required reading. So you pronounced your last name Baron?
I say Baran.
Baran?
Yeah.
Like French? Like Baran?
It was Baron when my dad came here. And he.
Where'd he come from?
The Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at the time.
Oh, really? Did he come here in the 70s?
In the 60s. Mm. So he escaped.
Did he have family there still?
Yeah.
All the way through it?
Yeah. His mother was still there. He was very sad when his mother died. Like, it was...
Because he couldn't go back?
Yeah, it was exactly like that, where he was really furious. He was, like, really angry.
For, like, your entire childhood?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, like, he had a good humor about him, but he was really mad at the communists. He was really mad at the Nazis. He remembered the Nazis. And
those are two fine people. Yeah. Those are good villains.
Yeah, exactly. So when he went back in, like, 91. I was too young. He didn't take me with him, but he just said that, like... He went back and everyone was like, oh, that's a ghost. Like some people got scared, like, because when he came back, some people would jump because they're like, you disappeared.
Wow.
And when people did that, they just never talked about them again. So it was like, they thought that he just got killed.
Oh, so they thought, I get it.
Yeah, because it was that repressive.
And your mom was from there too?
No, my mom was from here. She's on that side, like Ukrainian and Polish, so still Slavic on that side as well. But their generation came one generation before, like in the like kind of old Baltimore folks who came in the beginning of the 19th century.
Baltimore. You grew up in Baltimore.
Yeah.
So you've been, now this, I first read your stuff when you wrote the piece about 4chan. I don't know where you wrote that, but it got around.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, it was a sort of an eye opener for me, but you've been, you know, so you've been out here in LA before. You weren't essentially a journalist.
No, not at all. I mean, I considered myself an artist and a writer first.
Yeah. What was your focus? You wanted to, you sort of computer compelled.
Right. Yeah. So I really wanted to be a writer. I was writing novels that weren't getting sold. And really early on in my career, right after I got out of college, I had made comics with a really talented friend of mine.
Who's that?
David Hellman. He is a visual artist, and he made a video game that everyone loves called Braid. And before that, we were making comics, and really, I think on account of him, but I guess both of us, the comics were relatively successful. So then I started making comics for a while, but it was really like, oh, well, this is the sugar in the medicine where I can write and if I draw. So I was making comics, and then we were doing cartoons. But I really wanted to write that whole time. And so through that time, I was writing little essays that were kind of like Zizekian, like a little bit like that, where I thought, oh, well, that Zizek kind of reminded me of my dad. It was sort of the same intellectual tradition. Yeah. And I was into those concepts. So I was writing these essays on Tumblr, and kids were into them, though it was very weird. I felt like I was kind of ruining my career by being angry and writing about socialism and like inequality and stuff, and pop culture. And so the 4chan essay came out of that. It was just in that tradition where our cartoon for Cartoon Network, we had done a pitch and they had paid us money to develop it, and that collapsed. And I was like, oh, well, I'll just write another essay. Because I didn't expect, you know, I didn't get paid. I pitched it to a few places and they said no. And then I just self-published it. So that's...
And it got around.
Yeah, that's where it came from, yeah.
But the thing is, like, I think the thing that blew my mind, and some of the stuff I want to move through with this, with talking to you, is that, like, you know, I'm 55, all right? So all this stuff to me, it was like, oh my God, this is the machinations. Like, you know, when I guess the point is, like, when news would break, like the ultimate end game of this momentum that started with 2chan and moved through anime into meme culture, into you know, kind of morally bankrupt millennials, to being co-opted by the alt-right, is that and the sort of evolution of their, you know, engagement reality being sort of non-reality until it hits reality. So by the time I saw, you know, news that, or news cycles move around some of the information, you know, that came with the beginning of Trump and just before Trump, there was definitely a moment of like, where is this fucking coming from? There's a whole world out there that I think was rooted in fantasy, but then sort of found its way into the mainstream.
Right.
And I'll tell you honestly where it first dawned on me that something was fucked up. You know, I think it's the way you open the book. It's been a month or so since I read it, and I read it, you know, I was into it. Was that I started to see this footage of these protests that would happen between, you know, alt-right or white nationalists and Antifa. Is that how you say it? Antifa?
Yeah, that's how I say it.
And, you know, and when I looked at the people in the pictures, I'm like, this is not an organized thing. These people don't look like they know each other. They're dressed kind of oddly. They don't look like they get outside much. It looks like cosplay.
Right, exactly right, yeah.
And then, like, after I read your book, I was like, oh, it kind of was.
Yeah.
Like, but the news media,
right?
You know, is they exploit it, and I'm sure that the Trump administration knows to do that.
Right.
That it's sort of like, this is really happening. Look at these social forces, when really they're just sort of, you know, mobilized, you know, by a miracle, you know, computer nerds,
right,
who are out there living this. You know, they've made an impact on reality, and they're going to journey into it in these characters,
right.
I call them the army of unfuckable hate nerds.
Yeah, that's a very good name. My editors were like, we should have said that. We should have named it that.
You heard that one?
Yeah.
So, but I know in reading this stuff that, you know, this was your community to some degree. Mm-hmm. How old are you?
I am 38.
All right, so let's go back to when, you know, this start, when, because I'm not computer proficient. I'm not a fantasy fan. I don't know about these worlds of Minecraft
and so and, lucky.
And what's the other war one?
World of Warcraft.
Yeah, World of Warcraft. Right. Yeah. Like, I don't know about gamer culture. I missed it. I'm 55. I missed it. But you grew up in it.
Sure, more or less, yeah.
Because you talk about going to these conventions.
Right.
Before when the Chan community was sort of this esoteric Japanese obsessive community.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So how did, like, so what was it like then? I mean, who were the characters? Who were this tribe of people?
Strangely enough, yeah, like I kind of saw them at the very beginning when they first coalesced in the late 90s and then the early 2000s.
Who are they?
So a lot of nerds on the internet.
Yeah. Okay.
And a lot of people who had really dropped out. So Something Awful, which came before 4chan and stuff.
Something Awful, the name, it came from Something Awful. It's not just a name. Something Awful is a board.
Right.
Would you call it that? Is that what
it's
called?
Yeah, it was a popular message board. And it was really devoted to self-hating nerds, was how they called themselves, where they had dropped out of life. They were very nihilistic. And youth culture had gotten very nihilistic about dropping out, the sort of slacker 90s thing.
But could you see it? I mean, were these your friends?
To me, it was my youth culture, yeah, that I just didn't know why it was happening. It took me years to kind of figure out.
So what were you doing in it? What was your sort of focus? What was your thing, your nerd thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly with my friends was sort of very steeped in pop culture, and we would be kind of quoting pop culture, and we would kind of be into very dark, violent films and sort of transgressive.
On the boards?
So the boards, I barely posted on Something Awful, but I remember joining it like in high school or like early college or something, and kind of being into like, oh, looking at weird stuff and looking at dark stuff and then also comics.
So where does it all start? So sort of lay it out like you're talking to your father.
Sure, right. So I can break it down in a nutshell. So the overview is that by 2003, Something Awful spawns 4chan, which is this site which combines the sort of
But what is 2chan?
So 2chan was a Japanese site that was devoted to otakuism and this idea that first started in Japan that got imported to the United States, where young people really drop out of life. And instead of climbing the hierarchy and like competing in school and jobs, they say, well, I'm just going to drop out of life and I'm going to consume stuff and I'm going to consume fantasy products and live inside that fantasy
world. So this was a philosophical manifesto of 2chan, is that, you know, we're screwed. The hierarchy's bullshit. You know, there is no opportunity. It's nihilistic in its nature. And we're going to sort of live alone and engage with each other on this platform.
Yeah, it was a sociological problem in Japan.
And what was the focus? It was anime, right?
Yeah, it was anime. So it was about, so really the forces that created it were life was very hyper competitive and you had to do a lot to kind of climb up out of your parents' basement.
Mm-hmm.
And then fantasy products and entertainment products were just expanding vastly.
People love it. But right. People here, they're fetishized Japanese fantasy and animation products.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So those dynamics, the same things then happened in the U.S.
Now, what was the, like, now, let's just, like, search, let me just explain to me the sexual component of 2chan, or did that not happen? There was an element of people fantasizing sexually about cartoon characters.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there was sort of a romantic attachment to these men. They didn't get out much. It was mostly men.
Young men.
Yeah, young men, and they lived their sexual fantasy life in cartoons and video games and anime and things like that. So that was really part of it, that those products, it's really about selling power to powerless people. So that's sort of the violent action part.
Right.
And then selling sexual fantasies. So they're like, well, I'm not going to do that in real life. I'm going to do the much more unsatisfying thing of just getting all my gratification and pleasure through those commodities.
And like, you know, just at the core of it, I think what becomes interesting through the evolution of what you write about is that, you know, what this is doing to any sort of genuine perception of reality.
Right.
What that might be, whatever that might be, is that, you know, when you commit to engaging with people sort of anonymously or people you know by their screen name, and you have these communities around these different things, is that there is no genuine sort of physical social interaction. And it sort of tends to, it seems that it breaks down your ability to function in the real world to a degree when your entire social life and moral universe is built around this engagement around this specific thing and sort of onanism, that you're kind of retarding yourself somehow.
Yeah, it's deeply unhealthy, and it got unhealthier as it went along. So at first, you know.
So when 2chan gets here, it becomes 4chan?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the American import is 4chan, and it was started by a Something Awful user, a 15-year-old kid who was sort of an anime.
15-year-old kid.
Yeah, a 15-year-old kid who was living in New York.
So Something Awful was already existing.
Yeah, Something Awful existed, I think, in 1998 or 1999.
So this was the one that you sort of looked at. This was a site that was primarily about, you know, offending people in the community.
Right.
And sharing, you know, violent memes. It was sort of the beginning of meme culture, correct?
Yeah. Something Awful and 4chan more or less invented the internet meme. So it was banned on Something Awful because they thought it wasn't funny enough to sort of repeat a joke and change it. They felt like, oh, you have to be more original.
Right.
And then 4chan really popularized it. So that idea.
The meme idea.
Right. The idea of like replicating a joke over and over and kind of polishing it that way. And yeah, it really came off of 4chan.
And these people, the ones who were pulling clips and pulling pieces from movies, the way you frame it was, a way of appropriating and turning mainstream culture on itself, right?
Yeah, they felt really powerless that they were sort of at the bottom of this like sea of psychic garbage, which was the internet, which was all this marketing culture, and they had all of these different products and video games and anime, like all tugging on their value system. And Americans were a little more wary of it than the Japanese, so that they already knew from counterculture and slacker culture that it sucked. So they're like, oh, well, it sucks and really there's nothing to do. So we're just going to play with it. We're going to gain some autonomy over it by kind of reversing the flow and letting, instead of the screen sort of dictating what's on it, you get to like take all that stuff and make your own jokes out of it.
Right. So you deconstruct it and turn it on itself. And then, you know, you share it. And a lot of times what I thought was interesting about the beginning of this, and maybe you were living it, but it seems that there's, you know, the generational difference between, you know, young people who are completely computer proficient and their parents is profound. So whatever values were happening in the dining room or in the house, really it seemed that what you're documenting is that the complete disconnect between, you know, old school American values or things that parents can even teach their kids in any practical way or even school was now like, you know, I don't know what my kid's doing. He's down the hall on the computer,
sure.
You know, turning his brain into nihilistic, immoral garbage.
Sure.
And there's nothing that they can do about it. Like there's I don't even know that they would know. That was the one thing that struck me is that, you know, there's this value system that the kids are essentially fighting against.
Right.
Consumer culture and just, you know, mainstream values that they're not even existing in the same world as their parents in the living room.
Right. Yeah. And so what happened really is that gap that you're describing got wider and wider. So my generation, we kind of saw this labyrinth of addictive internet and all the interesting things about the internet sort of grow up around us. But then the next generations were born into it, really.
Yeah.
So ours.
How old are they now, that generation?
They're like 1920, right? Mm-hmm. And they inherit it from the sort of the culture that ours built on the internet. But back then it was, yeah, it was about a counterculture. It was sort of about getting agency over it. And then it kind of slowly reversed itself so that as you spent more time, the next generations, as they just spent all their time on the internet, and the internet got more addictive, got more fascinating, the games got more expansive, better. It was really just, it was sort of hyper-otakuism when that stuff in the 90s were dropping out. It was really like you could live your whole life there more than ever.
In the 90s.
That's like now in the 2000s. So
4chan...
what happened is that they created memes, which was really sort of a rebellious, kind of fun counterculture, and they felt very powerful. They felt like, oh, they were affecting society, and they were also created trolling collectives, which
let's talk about that. So when they were affecting society, when do you sort of mark? So what are you doing at this point? When do you start to realize personally that this shit is going bad?
I would say they had a very, between 2008 and 2011, they had a very successful sort of far left libertarian hacktivist collective, which I liked. I was a fan of. It was a really rebellious, sort of interesting way.
So it's sort of punk, the extension of punk rock.
Yeah, they had reversed their otakuism, where it totally flipped. And they said, oh, we're very powerful. We're going to fight corporations. We're going to fight...
with Anonymous.
Governments, right. Yeah, that's Anonymous.
Yeah.
And it's pro-democracy.
Right.
And then that collapsed. Those people got arrested. And by 2014 or 2015, I'm realizing that they switched back to this really deep, worse otakuism, which is
otakuism.
Sort of, I guess that's my own term for it. They have their own terms, like
otakuism, referring back to the 2chan.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
How do you define it?
Dropping out, like, and nihilistically living through the computer screen.
Well, I think that what's interesting, though, in the jump from that Japanese model, where the cultural expectations, sociologically, are much more intense. There is a hierarchy there in expectations, where the way it translates to America, which I thought you documented very well, is, you know, that sort of heightened understanding of consumer culture and realizing that, you know, the future that is presented to you and the possibilities that are presented to you in the American capitalistic model are mostly bullshit for most people.
Right. Yeah.
And that you claim in the book that a lot of these younger people were hip to that they were fucked out of the gate.
That's exactly right. Yeah. They kind of knew that life didn't really offer them fulfilling work. That's sort of an old philosophical complaint that goes back a while, right? That you're like, oh, well, it's really hard to be an artist. It took me years of dropping out to be an artist.
But even these guys that with these basic computer skills, that the best thing we were going to hope for is some sort of elevated cubicle job that might get them a good salary, but would you know, drain them of their life force, and the expectations would be limited.
Right, yeah. Like, the complaints in the 90s were like, oh, even if we do this, yeah, we're just going to get shuffled into a cubicle. And then now, it just got worse and worse, right? The options that you take on more student debt, you get less money. There's not even those jobs left. So
This is what American otakuism?
Otaku, yeah.
Otakuism?
Sure.
Okay, so that's how that kind of, that's why it stuck. So it took a sort of an intellectual, you know, jump and a cultural assessment that was a little broader than the Japanese trip,
right?
To really take in the American kind of existential predicament for younger people.
Right.
Now, when you say a 15-year-old started something awful, was, you know, that was pre-4chan?
Yeah, I mean, most of the book is about 4chan, and the Something Awful, the founder was in his 20s. So 4chan was founded by the 15-year-old.
Now, when you say in his 20s, so this guy, you know, what does he set out? Like, because you talk a lot about how the site is managed and what'll pass and what won't pass. There's a sort of autonomous kind of like a collective vibe to it, where there are no rules, but eventually something bad happens and then there are a few rules.
Right, yeah. So the first one, Something Awful, is relatively well moderated. So there are rules there.
Yeah.
And then 4chan,
what
really,
were the rules?
Just rules against harassment, rules against illegal content.
Right.
And then the enforcement was fairly good and it got better over the years.
Uh-huh.
But 4chan, because it took over that mantle of Something Awful, because it had much worse moderation.
How did that sort of happen? How did 4chan, we'll get back to Anonymous, but how did, you know, what was the movement that said, well, fuck Something Awful, you know, we're doing this now? Who was that guy?
So yeah, that was a 15-year-old kid and his friends who said they were on Something Awful, and they said, well, we're getting banned, or we want something even sillier and stupider. And the way that the 4chan worked, it was a little more fun and easier to post on. So they created their own separate site, which was 4chan, which is sort of a different style of message board, which is a little more fun, easier to post images. And over there, also that culture they inherited of really cynicism and dark jokes, and really lax, and then much more lax moderation, there was sort of this, in that culture, there was this race to the bottom of like, who can be, the Something Awful founder put it to me, like, there was a competition to see who could be the most fucked up piece of shit possible, and they were all winning, all of them referring to the 4chan guys, right? So this idea that like, you're gonna do the worst shit there, and it's really just gonna be this chaotic free-for-all.
And at so, 4chan.
Yeah, so between 2003 when it was founded and 2008 when they really started their hacktivist movement and the culture flipped for a little while, it was really about competitive transgression, about like just posting weird garbage and jokes. And
you know, the worst sort of, you know, racist, sexist,
yeah,
completely, you know, morally bankrupt images,
yep,
violence,
yeah,
you know, bordering on illegal,
yeah,
and so what struck me about that was that this is a large community. You're talking about thousands of mostly young men,
yes,
who are basically voluntarily, you know, through, you know, anonymous names,
yes,
destroying any possibility of them having a moral compass in the real world.
Yeah, that's exactly right, that it really screwed them up, that you can't kind of absorb that.
And that was the beginning of troll culture, was that they would do it to each other and get a big kick out of it, right? Like, you know, oh, you got me, that annihilated my entire sense of self. I feel like I'm bathing in that, but now I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
And that was the nature of what, you know, became troll culture in the mainstream. But initially, it was just a bunch of nihilistic, cynical, you know, frustrated young men trying to out disgust and destroy each other through memes and sayings.
Yeah, that's exactly
jokes.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and they were powerless, like young teenagers, young men trying to outcompete each other and humiliate each other, and they were all behind the screen, so they knew there weren't really any consequences.
And simultaneously, most of these people were involved with role-playing games.
Yeah, it definitely clicked into that culture, the nerd culture, hanging out in video games. But there was this idea that, like, they were self-hating. So the idea that you would leap into escapist worlds and fantasy worlds and live that way.
Yeah.
The troll culture was about destroying those fantasy worlds and saying...
Oh, so they were against them, too.
Yeah, so they're saying, well, we live on the internet. We spend all our time on the internet. We've dropped out, and we're nihilists who are just going to throw away our lives, boil away our lives on the internet. And
yeah,
if someone else is like in a fantasy world doing that, I'm going to go over and destroy their experience. That was the troll culture.
So, oh, right. So the original target was the fantasy nerds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So like,
these were the armies of online armies,
yeah,
of young men mostly. This was the battle. It's like, you know, the nihilists versus the fantasy nerds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if they were like, you know, they were middle-aged women who were going on Second Life, which was like a place where you could have a different fantasy world online and like live a totally different life through the computer.
Yeah.
And they would go on there and they would just destroy the, you know, like drop memes everywhere and make gross jokes and like put racial slurs in there. And the same thing with little kids who were like there on like a fantasy Lego style place that was run, that like some corporation was collecting money from the kids,
yeah,
to like, then they would raid it and destroy it. That was what they delighted in doing.
They hacked into it?
You didn't have to
hack into it. You just do it through the comment boards.
Yeah, they would find some way to exploit it. They would hack it so that they would figure out, okay, well, if we do this, we can actually create 7,000 new avatars, characters, and you know, totally overwhelm the people that are in there or whatever. Sort of thing.
With garbage.
Yeah, with just garbage jokes and memes.
They succeeded in ruining a lot of people's fun.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And now they've ruined the world's fun, evolution.
Yeah, they realized that they actually had a lot of power online. So they started doing it to neo-Nazis around 2007.
Well,
yeah.
Well, let's go back. So let's go, the next turn was that, you know, what do you see happen with troll culture to where, you know, was there a leader that said, you know, why don't we apply this to anti-corporate, you know, more progressive methodology? Like, you know, the difference between the two Anonymouses, the original Anonymous, which was a hacker culture of progressive activists.
Right.
And that's where, you know, you were like, well, now this seems to be going somewhere.
Right.
As a creative person. Yeah. Now, but when you're talking about this troll culture, I mean, we're talking about tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people involved in this, correct?
Yes. Yeah, 4chan, by 2010, it was the second most popular message board by some counts online. So one of the 4chan. Most successful sites.
So 4chan, by 2010. Now, yeah, I'm a grown-ass man, and that's like 9 years ago. So sure. I'm in my 40s,
sure.
And I don't even know what that is. And
sure.
And meanwhile, what's percolating there
right.
is this sort of undoing of culture. In a way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So all of this culture that's influencing everyone, memes and so forth, it's coming out of there.
Okay, so what changes, you know, for that crew, for that army of monsters, to where enough of them decide to do something, you know, proactive?
Yeah, they realize they have a lot of power.
Okay.
They started pranking neo-Nazis, a neo-Nazi named Hal Turner, and they essentially hacked him so thoroughly that they revealed that he was an FBI informant. And so by 2008, they realized, okay, well, we're this collective of millions of kids or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids. We have some skilled hackers in our
yeah.
group, and we have a set of values, and we can enforce those values. And that came out of, weirdly enough... Tom Cruise there was a video of him talking, sort of ranting about Scientology, the Church of Scientology got it removed, and 4chan was very angry. They said, oh, we love funny stuff on the internet. We love internet freedom. We all agree on that value.
Yeah.
So they went to war with the Church of Scientology, sort of linking up with older groups that had been doing that for a long time. And they were relatively successful. So I went out to their first protest. That was the first anonymous protest where around the world they said, okay, Scientology, on a certain day, we are this powerful international group of hackers. And on a certain day, we're going to come out and protest. You're going to see thousands of us in front around the world, all your churches, all your temples.
And this, but that was like, they didn't know that they were just talking shit, right?
That's what they promised, and it happened that indeed, like, they decided that it would be so funny. It was partly like it was a real life raid. So what they had been doing in virtual spaces and
yeah.
in kids games and stuff, they said, well, let's just do that in real life. Let's all go out on a certain day. Let's wear a mask. And they chose the Guy Fawkes mask, the anonymous mask. And they said, we'll pretend like we're this horrible or we're this incredible, powerful group of international hackers, which in a sense they were, in a sense they weren't. They were pretending.
But they didn't exist in the real world,
like
in the world of visceral reality.
Yeah.
Like they didn't go outside. So this is like a big day.
Yeah, it was a huge, yeah. Like everyone, I did not think they would show up, right?
Yeah.
I was like, this is unprecedented. Where they did meet at anime conventions, at my old anime convention in Baltimore, but this idea that they would suddenly become the opposite of nihilists. They would be like, we're politically engaged, we have a value system, and we're going to fight for it, right? Like the total mm-hmm. opposite.
But you remember these kids from anime conventions
yeah.
kind of slinking around and looking at tables of toys and whatnot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That they would come and meet at the anime convention, they would all sing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme song in the
round. But there was an innocence to it.
Yeah, they were goofy kids goofing off. They were in costumes, right?
Right.
So when they go out for the protests, they're the same thing. They dress up as the same avatars that they had raided the virtual spaces in. It's very goofy. They're cracking jokes. They're saying memes. But at the same time, no one knows what's happening, right? Like, I interview the Scientology guy across the street, and he's like, these are terrorists. They're coming to destroy us. They hate our religious freedoms. And they were intimidated. The press picked it up, and they're like, wow, this international hacktivist group, that's very powerful. They were pretending to be an international society of secret hacktivists.
But what they were really...
was the same... anonymous groups of trolls that hung out on 4chan. And they were named anonymous when they were just a trolling group in 2006 and 2007. They called themselves anonymous.
So they, when they were monsters.
Yeah, when they were just goofy monsters destroying people's experience online. They called themselves anonymous
okay.
with a capital A.
And then after the Scientology thing, they're like, well, we mean something.
Yeah, and we've convinced the press that we exist, that it's real. And so that mask became the face. They were like, that's who we are. We've convinced people that that's who we are.
Yeah.
And it really just took off.
So we'll be that.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a lull, but by 2010 and 2011, when the Julian Assange WikiLeaks stuff happened,
yeah.
They got re-engaged and they said, we will fight for Julian Assange. We're going to take down PayPal and MasterCard, who took over, who took his funds. We're going to attack them online, take down the sites.
And they did?
Yeah, they did. It was sort of semi-successful, but really successful for coalescing the group back together. And there were some really skilled, powerful hackers who then went on to sort of fly this flag of internet freedom and pro-democracy. They interfered or helped the revolution in Tunisia and the Arab Spring. That was part of what they did. And they still exist to some extent, but the FBI got very interested, very involved, and really crushed them, really arrested all of the principal members. Those guys went to jail. A lot of them were in England, and they are now out of jail. But Jeremy Hammond, one of the anonymous members who got arrested then, he in the U.S., he's still in jail. That broke the back of the movement.
Right. So this, when reality, the laws of reality, whether you agree with them or not, you know, there was real consequences. So the jail wasn't your self-designed jail in the one-bedroom apartment or you're in your parents' house.
Right.
It was now that you've ventured out into the real world,
right,
you know, and had real impact that, you know, the real laws apply. So this was, you know, the mindset that, you know, coalesced these troll armies who had, you know, sort of cynically were just outdoing themselves with disgusting things online. You know, now, you know, took really the sort of gamer approach to start. Now the game is the actual world. And, you know, we've shown this show of force. We all, as a goof, we all went out. We had our masks on. Now we've made an impact. And now we've made, some time goes by and we've made an impact again. And there's some progressive change going on because of what we're doing. Yet I imagine there's still a large faction of them are still monsters.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was a big split.
So there's a split in Anonymous.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the Hacktivist Collective was very inspiring.
I think everybody thought it was kind of amazing. And I think people of my generation were like, what is this?
Yeah.
And you sort of explain it. So, okay, so what happens? So this is about where you become disillusioned.
Yeah, well, at this point, I felt in the 90s the same way, where I felt kind of powerless and dropped out.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was really amazing that they had used the screen as a way and the internet as a way to sort of express autonomy, to be powerful in a sense. Mm-hmm. But there was a split online. So half of them still felt like that old otaku nihilistic way, where they said this idea that you're going to go out and pretend to make an effect is an illusion, and in fact we're still about trolling, we're still about dropping out of life. And after they got Anonymous got arrested around 2012, what happened was the 4chan, there was a moral vacuum, as one person described it, that all of those people had left, they had gone to other sites or they had been arrested. So what was left were people who were more into otaku culture than ever, more into dropping out, deeper nihilists, and then the new kids joining these places. They had even less opportunity to move out of their parents for fulfilling work or fulfilling lives.
So it's a new, younger generation.
Yeah.
These are 12 to 15, 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
So they're coming into some sort of well-defined, deep bottom, dark, cynical, attack culture, online attack culture.
Yeah, it's all well-defined by the generation before them and by the guys who, 10 years have passed and, you're spending 10 years on 4chan, right? Okay, it's funny in 1999 when you're on something awful. Funny in 2004, you're like, haha, I spent all my time on the computer, life sucks. Then, six, 7 years pass, you're still doing it, right? It just gets darker, right? That they're like, oh, this is
well, my... Well, yeah, because now they're grown up with grown up needs. Yeah. And now it's the world of pedophilia enters the fucking...
Yeah, right. When they're 15, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But if they're doing the same thing for 7 or 8 years,
yeah,
then it's like, oh, this is my life. Nothing has changed.
Compounded loserness.
Yeah, exactly right.
But I thought what was also interesting in terms of the cultural power of the righteous Anonymous was that, in response, I guess at the same time, if I'm remembering correctly, that once Anonymous became empowered politically, that Tumblr sort of, surfaced as a almost feminist reaction to it. Is that what happened?
Yeah, more or less that Tumblr was another site where memes were popular and you could share memes, and it was image based, so you could share a lot of images. And it turned into the female version, in a sense, where
it's also built on, you know, the feminine fantasy world, right? So the girl nerds,
right,
and their desires, which kind of you know kind of had to happen on its own, because the other place was a cynical, dark man's club, but they right. there was another thing going on there.
Right, yeah, there was sort of like this supportive community where everyone said, you know, if this is your thing, if this is what you're into, then we're going to support you.
No matter what.
Right,
yeah.
So it became this very sort of delicate crystal tower of...
gender fluid, progressive feminist values, and a type of fantasy that wasn't malignant.
Yeah, so... Right.
And longer posting possibilities and ways to explore ideas. And, you know, the way people could interact was to evolve a conversation around ideas.
Right. Yeah. So it was a little more it was very gentle, and it was sort of about celebrating art and mm-hmm. Celebrating counterculture. All of that was incorporated into it. And a lot of it was really great. A lot of it was really creative and interesting.
Well, I think what was interesting about it, and I don't know if you really put it this way in your book, but in the same way that the trolls were making headway, you know, instigating chaos, but also, you know, with political activism, is that it seems to me that the intellectual conversations around gender and sexuality that were happening on Tumblr were also surfacing in the mainstream.
Yeah.
That there was a cultural change that happened with my generation. You know, how do we source this? And it seems like a lot of the conversations around gender fluidity, new feminism, and sexuality were really on Tumblr.
Yes.
Before they entered into mainstream cultural conversations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those were the issues that they were very interested in.
Yeah.
Since it was young women, they said, you know, my life outside is sort of deeply dissatisfying, and they were getting together to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, can we use this feminist critique to understand what's happening? How, if I want to sort of escape the prison of being labeled of gender and all of the difficulties that come with a woman,
yeah.
being a woman, can I do that? Is there a critical theory that allows me to do that? I think a lot of the Tumblr ideas and culture are really great.
Mm-hmm.
But the critique of it I have in the book is that it too was really wrapped up in fantasy. So then it became, well, I'm going to express my freedom to choose and self-define and my through this cartoon, or sort of like if I see it happening in this film, or then me living in the fantasy world, just like the otaku were living in the fantasy world, sort of buying all these commodities will then set me free, when in fact it too was a little bit of a prison, or sort of distorted by that same process.
Yeah. Well, I had this kind of mind-blowing reality experience where I happened to be in Madison, Wisconsin, at the same time that this big fantasy convention was there. I forget what it's called. Do you know what it's called?
I'm not sure about the one in Madison, but God, they're everywhere now.
But I think it was primarily a feminist fantasy. And, you know, it was sort of dug in, but they were at my hotel. And, you know, and I was reading your book, and I'm like, I'm seeing this. This is the manifestation of this world,
right?
Which was very, you know, sweet in a lot of ways. That
right.
you know, it seemed to be encouraging a lot of personal expression through, you know, whatever you choose,
right?
You know, in terms of sexuality or gender representation,
right.
And I could see it.
Yeah,
that,
right.
But there was this sort of idea that this feeling I had was like, hey, these people. You know, this is their once a year thing,
right? Yeah,
where they
right.
can go do this and be around each other. I'm sure
yes.
there's smaller meetings and whatever.
Right.
You know, it seemed like the petri dish was at home and online, and this was the outing.
Right.
You dig, right?
Sure. Yeah. That certainly happens. Yeah, and they're bonding through products or whatever. Right. And so, you know, the critique that I offer in the book is that if you're really, really interested in cobbling together this mosaic of identity and self-defining and saying, you know, this is sort of what defines me, and this too, and this too. Well, that maybe that's just inherently how human beings act. But in fact, a lot of these kids were trained through social media and through their experience on the computer to do that, because that's what made money to the social media sites. Tumblr was a for-profit site. So
right.
That sort of youth culture grew out of the framework of self-obsession that social media was sort of teaching these kids how to do.
Right, and then once it gets onto Twitter or into Facebook and into my generation, you know, we don't know where to source it, but we feel that there's a cultural momentum, both progressive and anti-progressive, happening. But, you know, for me, it was sort of mind-blowing that, you know, it had been percolating for a long time. So now what we have, you know, just to be broad, is we have what's happening with Tumblr. We have what's happening with Anonymous, you know, in the progressive way, and then the small A Anonymous in the horrible malignant way. And, you know, these forces are all sort of around and making impact in mainstream culture and on the news and in the real world informationally. So how does it go bad? Because when it was already bad in some levels, but, right. You know, how does it become politicized, you know, into an army of people with a sort of incel or a hard right white supremacist agenda? Like when I first started seeing Pepe during the campaign and seeing it everywhere, and I didn't even know what hashtag MAGA meant, you know, at the initially.
Sure.
And I just knew that the frog was there, and I'm like, what's this frog? Is this funny? You know, there's a frog avatar, you know, saying shitty things to me. What, you know, what's with the sort of consistency of why there are so many frogs around? Like, so what happens to this world? Who turns these kids out? Who pimps them out? Are they older Nazis? How does it coagulate?
Sure, yeah. So,
am I jumping too many steps?
No. That we're right on time. Yeah, we're right. So around 2012, that's exactly what's happening. As I described that there were the old 4chaners who were left over, who were getting sadder. And then the new kids flowing
in. Guys in their 20s.
Right, yeah. And then the new kids flowing in who felt affected by the same dynamics.
American otakuism.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Who were just dropped out of life. They were not, right?
Down the hall from their parents.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's doing online.
Sure, exactly, right.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture just got worse and worse. Somehow, every time it got worse, no one expected it.
That now, you know, with these older guys who are now aligning themselves with, you know, other types of monsters who definitely have an agenda.
Right.
You know, old school white supremacists who are now becoming savvy. Richard Spencer and his crew are tech savvy. They come out of this world. And so now you've got these kind of completely morally shattered, you know, two generations of them through jokes and shitty behavior.
Yes.
And then...
Then Gamergate in 2014 really lifts the rock on it, where they didn't know they were a political coalition till then. So Gamergate was this harassment campaign that started on 4chan and then later moved to 4chan.
Can you explain exactly what happened in Gamergate?
Yeah, so there was a video game developer that 4chan was obsessed over, a female developer named Zoe Quinn, who they were harassing already a little bit, and then an ex posted a really angry screed against her, and they decided, just like in the old trolling days, they would target her, everyone would harass her, and it was really the biggest one yet. And instead of the like lighthearted kind of silly trolling of 2006 and 2007, it was really virulent, more so than, I mean, that happened
violently
in the
past. Violently sexist.
And they seemed genuine, which was the other thing about it. Like, that was their new issue, right? It wasn't irony. It wasn't cruel nihilism.
It's like, fuck her.
Yeah, they were really, really mad. And so the question was, like, well, why? Who are these people? And it turns out that, yeah, they had dropped out of life so much that they felt, they described it as, said, oh, we don't like that she's bringing feminism to video games. And the idea was that they felt that was their last line of retreat, that they, I don't have a real life, but at least I have misogynistic video games to live.
By men.
Yeah, right. To live a fantasy of seducing women there. And that was their threat. That's the threat they panicked over. And at the same time, they just really hated women. That it turns out that men who are in that environment, they just get more and more toxic. And the idea that, like, it's sour grapes, the idea that, like, oh, I can't get women, I'm not going to go outside and have romantic relationships. Well, then that becomes like, I hate women very easily.
It's weird because it strikes me that you know, many of them, And I'm projecting, you know, have unresolved sexual identity problems. They're not socialized in any way with women or really other, you know, normal men. And so, you know, this misogyny is born out of, you know, a virulent type of repression, that, you know, this weird sort of thing of like they think that they have all the freedom in the world to express their horrible views online and do whatever they want. And they may, but their sort of self-isolation has led to a type of repression of both, you know, identity and sexuality that of course is going to cause a kind of eruption of fucking self-hate that is manifested through misogyny and homophobia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That this is sort of the new part, that there was what's called a groupthink, where if unhealthy people get online together, they encourage the bad behavior, whether that's...
Well, you can find these niche, you know, communities for anything.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Like Thinspo was a Tumblr thing where women were being encouraged to be really thin and anorexic or whatever. So these new communities of young men were convincing themselves that they were on the right course, but they were a little fishbowl, right? It was like they were crammed themselves in this little corner of really toxic thinking. And of course, if you just go outside, right? If you just break out of that, there's this whole world. Mm. But it's just this really cramped, tiny, claustrophobic way of thinking.
And but they're also, they're breaking, like the thing that sort of becomes an issue for me and something that seems real is that, you know, the brain is fragile. Right. And, you know, once you start fucking with those wires, those neural pathways that distinguish between, you know, fact and fiction and reality and fantasy,
right,
and, you know, and sexuality and violence, you know, that it's sort of irreparable, you know, without a lot of work. And they're just doing it almost passively because they're so engaged.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, they're really doing harm to themselves.
Right.
They're really distorting themselves and just drinking poison, essentially. And they know it, right? There's always posts on the board where they're like, I got to get out of here. My therapist says I got to go. But
oh, really?
Yeah, like they know that it sucks at the same time. And then at the same time, they say, oh, well, I'm here forever. I'm doomed to live this way. I'm to be this.
Okay, so
forever.
Now you have this cauldron of misogyny. But, you know, where does the racism and anti-Semitism fold into that after Gamergate? So what happens with Gamergate? It gets big news. And what is the resolution of that?
So the takeaway, which no one really realized, is that all of these groups of young men, marginalized young men, realized they were a political coalition, that they had a lot in common, that they were anti-feminist, they were anti-Tumblr culture. So all of that stuff that the left said, you know.
Anti-gender politics.
Right. And that a lot is about...
Anti-politically correctness.
Right.
Right.
And a lot of that they saw as like that's about bringing everyone else, all the other groups, up to the status of cis white men, straight white men. And they said, oh, well, we're straight white men and we're on the bottom. Right. So they really deeply resented that, even though, you know, there was a lot of valid arguments on Tumblr for doing that, obviously. That's 2014. By 2015, Trump comes along. Gamergate peters out. Moot, the Christopher Poole, the founder of 4chan, is now in his 20s. He leaves 4chan. He says, oh, it's for different reasons. But essentially, the Gamergate made 4chan turn on him. So there's a leadership vacuum.
Yeah.
And what happens is a lot of sort of fake dads and older men who are sort of from the first generation get on YouTube and say, we're going to lead you. We're going to be the people who are going to tell you what your value system is. We'll sell you.
Who are these guys?
So Milo Yiannopoulos, Mike Cernovich. There's others I won't name, right?
Yeah.
But those are the more prominent that became sort of.
Where does Spencer fit in?
Spencer was part of. He was a part of this other weird tradition of fake intellectuals who were said. Who were really, he was such a hardcore Republican that he became a fascist.
Right.
And he really just jumped on this rising tide, like Cernovich and Yiannopoulos, but he wasn't really a 4chan guy. He just realized, oh, well, this is the answer for these men, and that's what I'm doing. So he was really an opportunist in that sense.
Okay, but Cernovich was a provocateur.
Yeah, Yiannopoulos and Cernovich made their name through Gamergate. They were Gamergaters. They were people who...
They filled the leadership vacuum in the misogynistic sort of white guy, you know, getting fucked area.
Yeah, and they're like, I'll tell these kids how to live. I'll tell these kids how to be men. That's what Cernovich did. And so Yiannopoulos said, you know, he's like, what you're doing is great. You're dropping out, living this nihilistic lifestyle. Don't go get a girlfriend. Just wait for virtual reality to get better. That was Yiannopoulos' message. And Cernovich was, how to be a man. I'll tell you how to be a man. I'll tell you how to pick up women. I'll tell you how to be an alpha male, because I know you guys are quote-unquote
beta males. But he's not really even an alpha. He's
right.
not really, like, what is
right.
that guy?
Right.
I mean,
yeah. So it's like the, it's like the tall.
I'm risking the
right.
collapse of
sure.
my Twitter feed
sure.
right now.
It's like the tallest of the dwarves, right? Like, right? That's exactly right. He's like, I am the most yeah. alpha loser there is.
But
right?
I saw this weird, like, this was another revealing moment for me, because I didn't know about the backstory, but I saw a video of Milo, you know, coming out of a place where there were a bunch of these guys waiting for him.
Right.
And, you know, he's very flamboyant. He's very out. He's clearly, you know, a showman of sorts. He was on to himself.
Right.
He was perfectly opportunistic, but, you know, he was out, you know, which can be sort of couched in some sort of progressive mode, but it's not.
Yeah, right.
Because the people he's talking to, they all wish they could be out, but they're not. But I just heard the mumblings and the teetering laughter, the tittering of these guys, whoever was holding the camera, and I'm like, these are ill-defined people, and they, you know, they
yes.
don't go out much, and they're
right.
you know, they're just excited to be around this guy's, you know, sexuality and his anger and his self-definition, because they
yes.
don't have any.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, they're kind of filling in as those guys are filling in as father figures, or
uh-huh.
right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that. That's the first thing that happened, is that these men sort of took over the leadership of this huge group of marginalized men,
yeah.
Young men. And where it clicked into Nazi ideology and far-right ideology was, well, first of all, they, in their crisis, they needed a lifeline of how to be. And turns out conservatism was...
their existential crisis as adolescents and young adults.
Yeah, uh-huh. And conservatism kind of gave this off-the-rack suit of values that said, oh, well, you just behave like you behaved in the past, right? Or this is how to be a man, raise a family. Sort of the breadwinner
uh-huh.
Set was they needed...
what they fought against, what they initially...
Exactly, right.
The values that they initially realized were bullshit.
Right, yeah, it came full circle, right?
From nihilism
right,
to fascism.
Right, so now they're like, we're on the margins, and what we're now dreaming of, especially the new ones, is being at the center of society. How do you become a normal breadwinner, middle-class guy? That's what I desperately want, but you have no money, you're in your mom's basement.
Yeah.
Right? So that conservative...
Now, the mom's basement thing becomes a working metaphor for any sort of self-isolation.
Yeah, that's exactly right,
Okay.
Yeah, so that appealed to them, and then that... often pushed into, so if you look at what fascism is, I use Hannah Arendt, who dissected it in the 30s, and it's really, she describes it there.
What in the totalitarianism.
Right, yeah. The origins of totalitarianism. She says, well, that one factor is that capitalism had displaced a huge group of people to make them superfluous, sort of the throes of economics had pushed all these people to the
yeah.
sides, and they had no definition,
right.
Which was what was happening again with these men.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens is there's sort of this cruel-minded value system, which is sort of, if you're not really thinking that much, you're not reading, that's the value system you inherit, which is sort of this social Darwinist determinism, which is...
Yeah, and if right. you have people who are confident and they package intellectual ideas in a tight way that gives you satisfaction emotionally and closure intellectually, you just glom onto it.
Right. Yeah. So these people were selling this idea that they say, oh, well, life is this cruel social Darwinist hierarchy, and there's alpha males and beta males, and you have to be cruel and claw your way to the top.
Uh-huh.
And you should admire people like Trump, who are also sort of flattered at being this sort of cruel minded business guy who perceives everyone as a competitor. And they said, oh, that makes so much sense to me. I'm on the bottom. It explains why I'm on the bottom. And so then it quickly became, oh, well, the way to get to the top is to displace these other people in this cruel
system.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, it's very dark, right? The idea is like, you know, life isn't a zero-sum game, right? People, when people work together, they pull everyone up. But they perceived it as like, oh, it's a power hierarchy. And the people on the top of the hierarchy, well, they cheated their way there. That's the minorities or whatever you focus on. And if I displace them, I'll get to the top.
So shameless corruption, shameless cheating, anything by any means necessary.
Right.
You destroy your competitors.
Right. And they're so angry that they're on the bottom. They're like, what's the explanation? Why am I here?
But
why?
All
right.
This stuff, they're still living online.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they're absorbing it as an answer to their situation online.
And so now where, like, I understand this part of it. So tell me where, where anti-Semitism, racism, and Pepe the Frog sort of take hold.
Sure. So the racism really grows out of that idea that we're on the bottom.
Oh, the white
because,
people.
Right,
I got
right.
that. Well, and then, anti-Semitism?
Yeah. It's,
that the Jews run everything.
Right, exactly. And, it's a like sort of like
they're the puppet masters.
Right, exactly. And of course,
so the blacks and the Latinos and the women are taking our jobs and the Jews are deciding who gets what.
Yeah, that's what they think. And
right.
then the other part is that they're people without identity, people who without context. And so they say, oh, well, I'll use. The last desperate attempt is say, oh, my whiteness provides my identity. Who are my friends? All the white people, right?
Right.
So that they find sort of like solidarity because they're so out, so alienated.
Now, how does Bannon step in? Bannon manages Milos because
yeah.
Milos is at Breitbart and Bannon seems some sort of, he sees some sort of rising star because of his odd sort of demeanor given his sexuality and, you know, Bannon having some weird psychological intuition, you know, sees him as somebody who is going to do the footwork for the new Trump army.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. So Bannon, Milo's working for Bannon. And
at Breitbart.
Right, and they yeah. realize Gamergate, this Gamergate coalition is there, that it loves Trump because Trump also sort of says to these men, I'm a winner, but I'm also sort of this beta loser. And I'm working for losers. I'm the big outsider
yeah.
who's going to make you win again.
Uh-huh. And they like the word winning.
Yeah, exactly.
Before.
Right. Right. Because like, who is that message to? But losers, right?
Yeah. yeah.
So this somewhat grassroots campaign is then exploited by Bannon and Yiannopoulos, and Bannon gives Yiannopoulos $1 million to go on a bus tour called the Dangerous Faggot Tour.
Yeah.
And says, you know, go bring this to life. Go bring these guys out. Go campaign for Trump. And that happens. And he's such a troll as he culls all this stuff from the chans that it's just a violent disaster.
Yeah.
So what occurs is that he goes to these colleges on the West Coast first, and there's shootings, there's stabbings,
yeah.
people attack him, and that turns into the riots at Berkeley, the so-called Battles of Berkeley.
And that's and a lot of the acting agents in that are what's left of the politically active Anonymous that is somehow tied to Antifa as well.
There are loose associations.
Right.
One of the Anonymous members was Antifa way back in the day.
Yeah.
And certainly, as now this split has occurred, it's strange. Yeah, the remaining Anonymous members have fought very virulently against the fascist elements.
So what Trump has been able to do post-election and even a little pre was that, so once this stuff sort of enters the real world through these protests, which is not, you know, it's not like the 60s where there's a coalescing of righteous activism. It's strange fantasy theater, a lot of it. I mean, it has real consequences, but he's able to, and the power structure is able to play it off as, you know, actual either terrorist threats or threats to democracy when right. when they all seem to be quite theatrical. Obviously, there are real consequences, but even in Charlottesville, that ragtag assembly of, you know, old school white nationalists and KKK people with these young white shirt wearing Spencerites who didn't, again, like not unlike the Scientology protests, didn't really look like they were socialized or gotten out much.
Right.
And they were having real consequences and killing people in real life.
Right, yeah. I mean, you saw the disparity there between what they expected sitting behind their screens and then their gap of reality testing when they actually got there. And they looked ridiculous with the tiki torches and murderous.
Mm.
Yeah, and they were performing. They realized that, how successful our event will be is how much it's covered in the press, what happens behind the screen, what happens online afterwards.
And the monster in charge, he played right into him. He knew. See, Trump is intuitively political and self, you know, and about survival. So his instincts are to play on the side of the losers who he's going to make win.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was really disgusting how he just refused to disown them just because they supported him.
But in electing them, though, the Russian troll event is something that is outside the parameters of the book, but that is happening at the same time.
Yeah, there's some slight connections where there are Russian trolls at the same time hacking Hillary's email and stuff
yeah.
like that. And the hacked emails are used to create, Cernovich uses them to create fake conspiracy theories around Hillary
yeah.
and to spread misinformation and troll that way because he realizes that the trolling collectives and all these men online will believe anything. So yeah, there's some vague connection. There's some connections there. But
there may not be an intentional unity, but everyone was operating in the same momentum.
Right. And it's deep, as you said, it's deeply confusing, right? It felt like reality, the internet was leaking into reality, right? That women.
Well, for my generation, it was, you know, I don't know that we necessarily, a lot of us or older, that they made the connection to the internet. It was just sort of like, what is happening?
Right.
Look what's on the news. There's a problem.
Right.
These kids are protesting, and this is they're Nazis, and there's these other elements. And, like, certainly Fox News is not giving any backstory to where this... They want to deny the goddamn Russian troll operation, the false information propaganda.
Right.
Intrusion on our... on our election. So they're not getting any backstory there. CNN's right. not giving any in-depth backstory like your book is. I mean, right. For me, in terms of, and I'm not a dumb guy, your book was, you know, the thing that, you know, made me understand it. I mean, you researched it well, you lived it to a certain degree when you were younger. This is your world, but how is anybody going to cover what we just covered in 2 minutes?
There are ways to get present. I mean, that's, I guess, my burden now when I go on other shows and they don't give me nice expansive time like you. They're like, all right, encapsulate it in 2 minutes.
But it's like when you lay it out like you do in the book, I mean, you can see, you know, that this is a cultural, political, psychological issue about our system and about, you know, people, you know, younger people, and about the nature of ideas and the brain and, you know, online and reality. I mean, it didn't happen out of nowhere.
Right. Right. So I use, to put it in a nutshell, I just use those underlying dynamics that created the whole thing, which is there's a lot of kids out there who have no access to fulfilling housing, all the real needs, right, that society is supposed to provide.
Yeah.
Fulfilling housing, fulfilling work, education, health. Like, our generation doesn't have any of those. But like all of the fake needs, all the garbage that you don't need, society is great at providing you with that, right? You can play video games and drop out all day. It's really easy to do that. It's really easy to live in these expansive screen worlds.
Yeah.
So when those two elements combine, you get this. You get people who are really angry at the status quo, young people who are really dropped out, really nihilistic, entrenched in fantasy.
Lots of them.
Yeah, just hordes of them.
Well, I mean, I think that's what you're seeing now that Trump is president, and now he's... It's just that when you have these defined people who define themselves as incels or sort of... Yeah, because these guys, some of these guys who are going out and shooting people in the name of immigration, you know, anti-immigration, anti-Jewish, anti-black, whatever it is, They're some of them are those 19 and 20 year old you know kids again who you know who have collapsed their ability to see, you know, consequences or to see, they're like involuntary Manchurian candidates.
Yeah.
That get activated and that, you know, the line between fantasy and reality doesn't exist, and they go out with their fucking guns, and you know, and I guess it seems like they're willing to face the consequences or see themselves as martyrs,
right?
You know, or see themselves as heroes online. So I think that the age that this has evolved into, once they put their man in charge, which is Trump, is that now, you know, there is an encouragement in an American authoritarian situation. You're not going to need thought police. You're not going to need a broader sort of armed enforcement of ideas when you have these guys ready to pop at any kind. If one of them pops, it gets publicized. People get afraid. People rethink what they're going to say and what they're going to do and where they're going to go. And then the same end is met by one of these fucking guys who just gets lit up and radicalized by these ideas.
Yeah, that's right. That's the new phase we're in now, post-Charlottesville, after they got really ashamed to be on the streets. They really became an alt-right terror epidemic, and that had stretched back for years on the chans. But now, as you say, they're 19, they're 20 years old. So
it was being encouraged by older white supremacists for years. They were trying to radicalize these kids.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, part of the story is that indeed older white supremacists, are like this always contingent of poor white Southerners and sort of people that have always been on the margins, and they were largely been online for a long time. They came to 4chan around 2012 and radicalized a lot of the otaku. But I really think it's a new thing that we're experiencing now, that like the new alt-right really started 2013 is very different. It's its own movement. What has occurred is that they're 19, 20-year-old kids. They're going on 4chan and 4chan's worst predecessor 8chan.
And Reddit?
A little bit Reddit. Reddit has been much better at cleaning that stuff up, but it's still pretty bad in places. So largely it fell to 8chan.
Yeah.
And what's happened is, like, you know, they're there for a year and a half and they get just brainwashed because it's all of this garbage is now so distilled and the culture is just so.
And now they have their martyrs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it becomes this tradition, like that's a meme, like going out and killing those people and being a murderer is like a set of memes and they just inherit the memes. And of course, teenagers do this like copycat suicide thing anyway. That's sort of like a psychological problem that happens.
Yeah.
Idolizing suicide is essentially what they've been doing for years. And then on top of that, idolizing action films, the power fantasies they're being sold in movies and anime.
So why not take a suicidal action that will have real world impact in the larger cause of winning for white people?
That's exactly right. And it steps them through the screen, right? Suddenly they become the thing on the screen, right? Mm. They become the other side of the action film.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, all right, so let's end a little lighter in that we didn't talk about the evolution of Pepe, because I know you were being followed by a documentary crew who was put together by the creator of Pepe the Frog, who is trying to get his frog back.
Yeah, he's trying to get it's coming back. Pepe, or the merry comedy and redemption of Pepe the Frog.
Well, what is the history of Pepe? How did he become turned out? How did he become the representation of nihilism and then white supremacy?
Yeah, so he really started as like an indie comic guy, and the comic was about being a gross dude living with roommates.
Yeah.
And it's sort of from my realm of web comics. And then Matt Fury, the creator, he's on the left. Nice guy. But 4chan 2006, 2007 adopts Pepe because he's just such a great cartoon that he looks like a loser. He looks like the symbol of being a loser, dropping out.
Yeah.
And that's what he means for many years.
Yeah.
But then when the loserdom gets so intense by 2012, 13 and the alt-right happens, then he becomes the symbol of that.
Yeah.
And they,
Richard Spencer's wearing a Pepe.
Yeah. And then there's this weird moment that no one understands when during Trump's inauguration, Spencer's pointing at his Pepe the Frog pin. He's like, oh, let's explain Pepe, my symbol. Yeah. And then he gets socked.
Oh, that's punch the Nazi in the face guy.
Yeah. Right. So, and then Hillary releases an explainer and she's like, Pepe is a far right symbol.
Yeah.
And Breitbart and Yiannopoulos, they love it. They're delighted that Hillary is behind the curve, that she doesn't really understand what's happening.
Yeah.
And so by this point, youth culture knows what Pepe means.
Yeah.
And so 2015, they're like, we're all Pepe. We're all this loser on the bottom. That's how we all feel.
Yeah.
Right. And they're mad that the alt-right, that subsection, stole it. And so Hillary looks a little ridiculous.
Right.
That it's sort of like thrown into the media mix.
Yeah.
And this is where Pepe has remained. But just this week, so he returned a little bit where he's kind of returned to his original position of just, I'm just a loser guy.
Yeah.
That's what he means now a little bit. But just this week, the protesters in Hong Kong have been using him. Just this morning, the New York Times ran an article that Pepe is now a symbol of democracy in Hong Kong. And all the youth, and it's the same. It's because that's how the kids in Hong Kong, they didn't know. They didn't even know about the alt-right. They said, we saw that frog. That's just how we felt. That's just like,
wow. So what's the name of the guy who created it?
Matt Fury.
Was he going to come today?
No, he moved a little north of here in California. It's his buddy, his animator friend who animates with him. So what happened? Yeah, they were going to do a Pepe the Frog animation, but then it got co-opted by the alt-right like at the exact same time. And now they're like, well, now we have to do a documentary that's animated about what the hell happened to Pepe. Yeah. And they wanted
was there copyright issues? I guess there's no way to deal with copyrights when you have meme culture.
Actually, that became its own crazy thing where no, there is, right? Like, I told them, like, when I first talked to them years, like,
who?
When it was first happening,
the Pepe people,
I was like, Matt, why isn't Matt enforcing his copyright? Yeah. Like, I know as an artist, like, you make it, you own it.
Yeah.
And then he started doing that. Maybe he had his own ideas doing it. I don't know how much I was at fault for that. But he sued Alex Jones, who was selling Pepe merchandise. He got a nice lawyer volunteer to sue all the alt-right people who were using Pepe to sort of reclaim Pepe as his.
Yeah. And how'd that go?
It went okay that he got $10,000-$15,000 from Alex Jones, which was small, I think, but it was something. And at least, like, they stopped using it. There was a guy that made a Pepe and Pede children's book. Pede is another meme that's like Donald Trump supporter.
Uh-huh.
And it was a really cruel, stupid children's book. And they got that, all, you know, like they got...
cease and desist.
Yeah, and they got money from them that they then donated to good causes that fight against that. And Fury himself is like, he makes like love Pepes now and like hippie Pepes. Because hippie, you know, like Pepe was like this cool, chilled out hippie guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Big Lebowski Pepe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for going through this.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
No, I love the book, and it, you know, it was very helpful to me, and I think it, you know, certainly, I think that people, you know, above 40, you know, who are not, you know, computer literate in the world of chans and platforms and subreddits and whatever, it's important to sort of get this perspective on how what happened happened.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that it's helpful because it was not particularly fun to drink poison for 2 years, but now I'm a male failure expert, so. Yeah.
And what are you doing with your failure? What's the next thing for you?
I want to go back to making creative work, whether that's novels or comics or something like that. That's hopefully something that's a little lighter than this.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad. Well, thank you for getting obsessively engaged with this stuff.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, thanks so much for talking to me about it.
Okay, that's it. Enjoy that book. Go read it. It came from something awful. I found it completely engaging. I appreciate Dale coming. It was educational for me. Nice fella. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my tour dates. I need you, Detroit, Toronto. Come on. Come on. It's okay if it's my last tour, but let's make it a big one. I'm not committing to that, but, you know, I don't know. We'll see. Now I'm going to play my Stratocaster, which I got out. It's a Stratocaster with flat wounds. And if you know what that means, you know what that means. Here we go. Boomer lives. Stratocaster.